Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Odessa, Odessa, a novel by Barbara Artson, narrated by Christina Delane. We love America. We love her beauty. We love her riches. We love her mountains and her forests. And we love the dreamers and the philosophers and the thinkers who are giving America liberty. But that must not make us blind to the social faults of America. That cannot make us deaf to the discords of America. Emma Goldman. 1. The Beginning. Chapter 1. Henya Khanna, Kill the Yids. October 1908 to 1909. Henya Khanna is a woman who no longer bleeds, so she puzzles over how this could have happened. Try as she might, she can't remember the last time she and Mendel were together. "We must have been," she thinks. "Otherwise, how could this be?" She smiles, thinking of how he touched her when they were younger. But now? The results of his touching were Fagel and Levy, followed by Shmuel and Avram, all born by her 33rd year. There was a respite of 4 years, not counting the one who died a week after his birth, followed by Disha, and 2 years later by Lieb. Henya can't recall a time when there wasn't a babe sucking at her breast, and 1, 2, or 3 toddlers tugging at the hemline of her skirt, all pleading for attention. God knows there was little enough to go around. And now, thinking another might be on its way, her heartbeat races, knowing full well the pressing burden of yet another mouth to feed. Without room enough for the children already born, she frets about where she will put this one. She frets about her languishing strength. She frets about whether, not whether, but when, the Cossacks will make another unwelcome visit. The violence against Jews since the Tsar's murder in 1881 leaves the community's nerves raw. And the peasant horde, encouraged by the authorities eager to reassign blame for the country's abominable conditions, even for the pogroms, points the finger at the Yids. Always the Yids. There is nothing Henya can do about her fears, so as the practical woman she is, she turns to those concerns she can do something about. "It's God's will. I'll put the baby in our room," she determines. With barely enough to keep her family dressed and with food in their stomachs, she worries whether her milk will last. "It was plenty before," she reassures herself. "But now, at my age..." She worries, too, about whether she can survive another labor, recalling the last, when she almost died. One day in November of the previous year, as she folded laundry, stiff and damp from the blistering winter weather, Henya caught sight of her hazy image in the mottled mirror that hangs above the threadbare couch, a hand-me-down from Mendel's family, and startled when she saw what looked to be the very likeness of her mother. "Mama," she murmured in disbelief. "Can that be you?" But when the question remained unanswered, she asked herself, "Who is that old lady staring back at me? I look just like Mama before she died." She shook her head from side to side as if to drive the reflection out of her rattled brain, and then withdrew her gaze and vowed to take better care of herself, knowing full well that she wouldn't, and couldn't. "What difference does it make? I never was a beauty anyway, and Mendel loved me then, so stop already with your fussing," she whispered, not wanting to awaken her sleeping husband. Henya has little time to preen in the morning. Her day begins before the cock crows and the sun rises. Today she haphazardly arranges her thinning, dappled salt-and-pepper hair into a bun at the nape of her neck, held together with oversized hairpins. Then she dons her scheitel, the wig for married Orthodox women, and tucks a strand of stray hair behind her ear. She hastily steps into the dark muslin duster she routinely places on the chair before falling, exhausted, into bed, and hurries to the kitchen to set water on the stove to boil in time for the children's wakening. She is a short, large-featured woman with heavy eyebrows that frame her large brown eyes, and although passably attractive in her youth, she has been worn down by a life of devotion to others' needs. Everyone's demands, stated and unstated, she places before her own. Henya is the first one that neighbors turn to when sick, or in need of extra oats or barley or wood or coal or counsel or water when winter limits their sparing supply. After all, she is the Rebbe Mendel's wife, and that's what a Rebbetzin must do. She loves and respects Mendel, a good but difficult man, who, as the wise man of the shtetl and teacher of young boys, totally devoted to the study of Torah, has little time to help with the children or the daily round of domestic chores, nor should he, she feels. He has more important things to do. It's not that she feels her role insignificant. It's just not for a Rebbe to do what she does. She was raised to know that the life of a Rebbe is one of contemplation, meditation, study, and prayer, and to know it is a woman's place to attend to her husband's needs. Growing up, she witnessed her mother performing the same routine. And at 14, when her mother died, Henya stepped in to fill the void. She cooked and cleaned, and attended to the vegetable garden and cared for her father and younger siblings. No one had to ask. She knew her duty then, and she knows it now. She gets little help from her three older children, who are seldom around when she needs them. Fagel, the oldest of the brood, spends most of the day with Yosef, her boyfriend, when she could be home helping Henya. For the most part, Henya accepts her lot in life without complaint, but at times she wonders what it would have been like if she had been allowed to study Torah, or at least learn how to read. She recalls how she would sit outside of her father's crowded study, littered with books, listening enraptured as he attempted to enlighten her brothers or the eager young scholars who came to their home to learn. It's October. Henya's thoughts drift to the approaching Russian winter and to the wind that rips across the Pale of Settlement, to the pogroms, and to the cramped quarters in which they live. She ponders the lack of water that will come with the hoarfrost. Then the water in the well that serves the shtetl is a frozen, glacier-like mass and leaves the residents without enough of that precious liquid. No water for bathing, little for cooking, and none to wet one's cracking lips. She sighs as she thinks of springtime, when the water carrier delivers fresh water daily from home to home, which she scoops from a large wooden pail that hangs precariously from a slender pole resting on his broad, muscular shoulders. A nice but simple man, she thinks. In November, when the river freezes over, Henya will daily direct one of the older boys to cut a square of ice that she will place in a cooking vessel over the stove to melt, but will supply barely enough water for cooking. The shortage of wood and coal makes it hard to get out of bed in the morning, especially for the younger children. At times, in the middle of the day, she will put them to bed to keep their lips from chattering and their limbs from turning blue. This, she reminds herself, is her life and her mother's life, and before that, her grandmother's life. Is it any wonder, she thinks, that the little ones wet the bed at night? Who wants to go outside to pish in the hut when it's warm under the blankets, their little bodies huddled together? I'm used to it, but they shouldn't know of such tsuris. Their home is confined. The older boys, Levi, Shmuel, and Avram, sleep on one side of the larger bedroom, while the girls, Fagel and Disha and little Lieb, sleep on the other side, partitioned by a worn-out sheet. There is a second bedroom, smaller by half, shared by Mendel and Henya, its cardboard-thin wall separating them from the children's bedroom. aside from a kitchen, if one could call the closet-sized alcove located in the living room a kitchen, with its diminutive window facing the porch, there is a tiny sitting room. There, a couch and several chairs rest on a once-colorful rug covering the irregular planked wooden floor. Fagel, at 18, is 13 years older than Disha and 15 years older than Lieb. She vehemently and frequently vents her resentment at having to share a room with the Kinder and at being her mother's slave, as she calls it. She hates it that the older boys get away with avoiding most chores. She hates their privileged position based solely on being a boy. Often she threatens to move in with Yosef and his parents, who live a mile or two away, or marry and move to America. Although desperate to escape the degradation she experiences in such constrained quarters, not to speak of the constant bedlam of her home, her outbursts mostly serve to irritate her father and to rid herself of the pent-up rage toward her oppressive life.
"All he wants are future rabbis to bear his name," she protests to her mother.
Mendel, out of helplessness, retaliates with threats of his own. He calls her a nafka, a whore.
"If it's privacy you want," he rants, "I'll show you privacy, your high and mighty Tsarina. You bring shame upon my head with your big mouth. Move in with Yosef. Over my dead body you'll move in with Yosef. You think it's better at his place with their 9 kids. Better you should be helping your mother."
Only to himself does Mendel acknowledge that this is no life for a girl of marriageable age. He knows it isn't good for her to sleep with the younger children, but she certainly can't sleep in the same room with the older boys. At times he notices Avram looking at Fagel in a way that makes his skin shiver.
"She should have her own room,"
he thinks, but then quickly reverses himself mid-thought to eradicate the pain of knowing there is nothing to be done. Mendel grows increasingly aggravated when his ruminations turn to whispered rumors that young men, even Jews, are being conscripted into the Russian army for 25 years. His own sons will go, and even Yosef, so who can blame her for wanting to go to America?
"Wouldn't I go myself if I had the money?"
His obstinacy keeps him from apologizing to Fagel after his heated outbursts, so when he next sees her, his remorse comes as a pat on her head. He determines once again to write to his 2 years older brother, Moish, in America, to ask for money to make the crossing. Yes, it would mean leaving Henya and the younger children behind, but he thinks it would be better than being here. And besides, with the geld you make in the new country, it would take a short time for him to send for the rest of his family and to repay his brother. The older children could work, and he could get a job as a teacher, and then as a rabbi in a small synagogue, they could start their life anew. Fagel never fulfills her oft-declared threat to live with Yosef, but she will leave for the new world in a little over a year, where she and Yosef will claim their new American identities as Mr. and Mrs. Joseph and Faye Biffson. From their tiny apartment on the Lower East Side, they will work conscientiously with the cast-off sewing machine Joseph at first borrows and then buys from his boss, a Landsman from Odessa, and then 2, 3, and 4 more, stitching elastic to the waistbands of ladies' bloomers. Joseph will work at his boss's factory during the day and return home to toil well into the night with his wife by his side. No one will imagine that this small venture, begun with the labor of Fagel and Yosef's needle-pricked fingers, will grow into a thriving enterprise that eventually will employ more than 30 people, one of whom will be little Disha. For the first several months, Henya refuses to admit that she might be pregnant. She goes to great lengths to avoid accepting that possibility. She attributes her lethargy and weight gain to getting old. By this age, she reminds herself, most of her friends had stopped bleeding, and some had even passed on. One of her sisters has already died from cholera, and a brother from tuberculosis, both before their 50th birthday. And her dear mother, blessed be her name, was 44 when she died from a growth that ravished her guts. In early January, when the bump begins to show, she dwells on the likelihood a tumor might be growing, and that she, like her mother...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?